I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Back in 1997, a 13-year-old girl told Tarana Burke that she was being sexually abused, and Burke did not know what to say. 10 years later, she started an organization, Just Be Incorporated, to help young victims of sexual assault and harassment, and she started the Me Too movement. Here she is on WNYC back in the fall about what she hopes this movement accomplishes.
We have a national spotlight now, and we have this moment where the attention of the world has been turned to talk about sexual violence, and that's something that we, you know, as unfortunate as it is, we have to take advantage of the moment to build momentum for the movement, right? The movement to end sexual violence is vast. There's so many people involved, and it's not centered on just one issue. So while sexual harassment is really serious and we want to combat that, we also want to broaden the conversation. And this moment with Me Too being viral has allowed us to broaden the conversation and talk about the spectrum of sexual violence.
Burke was a guest on actor Michelle Burke was a guest of actor Michelle Williams at the Golden Globes this past Sunday when Oprah delivered a stirring speech about how women have been empowered to speak out against their abusers.
What I know for sure is that speaking your truth is the most powerful tool we all have. And I'm especially proud and inspired by all the women who have felt strong enough and empowered enough to speak up and share their personal stories. Each of us in this room are celebrated because of the stories that we tell. And this year, we became the story. But it's not just a story affecting the entertainment industry. It's one that transcends any culture, geography, race, religion, politics, or workplace.
Today on Radio Times, where do we go from here? How do we ensure this movement doesn't become just a moment? And how do we differentiate between the predator and the jerk? And what do we do when we see harassment, even sexual assault? We asked Stephanie Kuntz to join us. She teaches history and family studies at Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington. She serves as director of research and public education at the Council on Contemporary Families, wrote a book called A Strange Stirring, The Feminine Mystique and American Women at the Dawn of the 1960s. Stephanie Kuntz, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Oh, thanks so much.
Also with us is Dahlia Lithwick, and she writes about the courts and the law for Slate, also hosts the podcast Amicus. Dahlia, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks for having me, Marty.
Dahlia, let me begin with you. I think a lot of people listened to Oprah and said, oh, good, the next president of the United States, she's going to save us from ourselves and she's going to make everything better for the United States of America. What message did you hear coming from her speech?
Yeah, I heard the opposite message, actually. I was really struck when I heard her speech about how profoundly not I'm in charge, I'm in power, I will lead you a speech it was. I thought it really rang deep in the key of, you know, Obama's message, Gandhi's message, be the change you want to see in the world, you know, empower yourself, tell your story, climb up out of your sense of invisibility and effectuate change. And so to me, it was such a speech about seizing power and being bold, and then within a nanosecond, Twitter was abuzz with Oprah 2020, and I
exactly.
thought, no, you've entirely missed the point of this speech.
Well, let me go to you, Stephanie. We could do a whole hour on this. We probably have, but I'm interested in how you see the Me Too movement, certainly comparing it to what was so much a part of the 1960s.
Well, I think that the Me Too movement has been extremely important. I think that it's, you know, that we're just beginning to realize people are just finally getting an idea of how pervasive it is for some men to assume they have a right not just to openly assess and discuss women's bodies and sexual attractiveness, which can be painful enough, but to sample what too many people still call the wares, you know, to extort sexual displays and services, and in many cases to outright forcibly engage in forcible assault and rape. So I think it's fabulous that people are beginning to understand how humiliating and painful that is. And I think personal stories are helpful to that. The dam has finally burst on this issue. I think it will be hard to go on ignoring or penalizing women, even the ones in low-wage and low-power jobs who have far less opportunity to tell their stories. and for management to buy silence from the women who have more credibility and clout, which with the result that they subsidize continuing predation. I do think, though, we have to figure out how to go beyond what Ofer said, speaking your truth in that kind of personal way, mm-hmm. to discuss what is going on, why it's going on, how we change the structural and social conditions that create this and that make that lead to abuses of power, not only against women, but also against men.
I want to pick up on every single thing that you just said there, Stephanie Kuntz. But Dahlia, I do want to go back with you, or back to you, because you had a really fascinating and very honest piece in Slate about Judge Alex Kaczynski. He was, until I guess recently, on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit, a very powerful circuit court. You had interactions with him. This was something like 20 years ago. A number of women have come forth to accuse him of sexual harassment and inappropriate behavior. The piece that you wrote is, he made us all victims and accomplices, and you kind of beat yourself up for not speaking out sooner.
Well, I think it goes to a lot of what Stephanie said just there about how we want to believe that when women entered the workforce, and then I think again in the wave of legislation and awareness post Anita Hill, I think we wanted to believe that we had crafted an architecture, a legal architecture, that would protect women, and in some ways we did, right? We have Title VII, and we have harassment training, and we all, every single one of us in our workplaces thinks we know the rules, and yet, as Stephanie says, this moment is a watershed, and it has smoked out the extent to which everything that we thought that was protecting all of us, it turns out wasn't protecting all of us, and more so that we were complicit in the failures of those systems. We weren't reporting. We weren't reporting things that were happening to ourselves. We weren't reporting things that we were seeing. So I was, I think, in that piece trying to think through what it is to live on this seam of, you know, we have strictures, we have statutes, we have policies, and yet they have failed mm-hmm. us, and then we've failed them by failing to come forward, by protecting our own privileges and our own successes, by daily, not just women, by the way, I think it's so important to say, by daily, as men and women, making the decision to protect our jobs, to protect our status, the belief that the systems aren't going to work, the belief that it's not going to change, that each of us colluded in making these systems that we thought were protecting us ineffectual.
Well, and as I said, I found the piece so fascinating and appreciated your honesty. From a more personal perspective, were you just, as you seem to indicate, just more worried about your job and also your future as a lawyer?
It was a really personal piece, and I you know me well enough to know I'm never comfortable writing
about my own
life. I know,
which is why it really struck me.
But I think that what I was trying to explain was the ways in which, and this is so acutely true, by the way, in this particular realm of the legal world, where these legal clerkships, these federal judicial clerkships, which are prized jobs, a handful of law students after law school get them. They're a springboard to clerkships at the Supreme Court and the best jobs at the best firms. These are the golden ring for law students. And the ways in which those jobs themselves create layers and layers of systems that allow for federal judges in this case to behave inappropriately, to say things and do things that are inappropriate, and for this to go on for years. I think the piece was about the ways in which this was a, quote, open secret. Everybody sort of knew that this particular judge was saying things and doing things that seemed to have crossed the line. And yet, as you say, I think that everyone, as you may remember, as the story played out, two women came forward.
That's
and then
right.
I came forward and other women came forward. And at some point, the judge stepped down. But the ways in which every single person coming forward 20 years later, in some cases, all said the same thing, which is, I just, how could I imperil my future and my job? This was the key to my whole future. And so I just sucked it up and did nothing.
Stephanie, let me go back to you. I'll be curious what you say about what Dahlia just described, but also, again, using you as our historian here, do you see progress then from the 1960s?
Oh, absolutely. You know, the fact that we're getting more a discussion of this and more reports of it is a result of the fact that people feel more entitled to object to it. So it's not as though it's a new epidemic. It was this behavior, many of these attitudes and behaviors were legitimized back in the 1950s. I could show you pages of respectable advice books from the 50s, 60s, even the early 70s that told guys that actually, and in this sense, we have to put historical perspective also in the range of kind of abuses that women are reporting, because men were told that they needed to push as hard as they could, because after all, women have been trained to say no even when they want it. Some of the same advice books told women they should pretend to resist before giving in. I have one in my on my bookshelf addressed to young women that says, "Remember, most men will go as far as you let them. So ask yourself what you did or wore." And in the late 70s, remember the song by the Pointer Sisters? "I say I don't like you, but you know I'm a liar." You know, Bruce Springsteen, I was surprised to find, who was a real supporter of women's rights, was the original author. None of this excuses the extortion or the force, but it explains why men in this era might not always have recognized how close they sometimes came to crossing the line. And that has stayed with us for quite a while. So there are also books to young men that explicitly say, go as far as you can, push, you know, et cetera. This was just part of the whole ambience of the time, and it no longer is, but we still have both the attitudes on the part of men that they are entitled, the fears on the part of women, and then the real lack of protections. And that's not just about sex and gender. We're, for example, unlike the European Union, which has laws prohibiting employers from retaliating against workers who ask for flex time, there is no protection for most workers in America against non-causal dismissals. So women, when they are subjected to this kind of sexual extortion, feel like they might lose their job. Men who are bullied and want to ask for family time, for example, we know that men are harassed not with a sexual assault, but with these tremendous gender bullying and discrimination when they ask for family time. They don't have any protections either.
Well,
so I think we have to talk about those structural issues
absolutely.
As well.
After this very short break, sorry, they're playing my song, talking with Stephanie Kuntz and Dahlia Lithwick. Stay with us. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane, talking with Dahlia Lithwick, who writes about the courts and the law for Slate, also hosts the podcast Amicus, and with Stephanie Kuntz, who teaches history and family studies at the Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington. She's also serves as director of research and public education at the Council on Contemporary Families. We are talking about the Me Too movement, where it goes from here. And you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me play something, and this goes back to December. In fact, it goes back a month. This is New York Senator Kirsten Gillibrand at a news conference and calling for Senator Al Franken to resign. This almost feels like ancient history. About a month ago, let's give it a listen.
Enough is enough. I mean, this is a conversation we've been having for a very long time, and it's a conversation that this country needs to have. And I think when we start having to talk about the differences between sexual assault and sexual harassment and unwanted groping, you are having the wrong conversation. You need to draw a line in the sand and say none of it is okay, none of it is acceptable, and we, as elected leaders, should absolutely be held to a higher standard, not a lower standard, and we should fundamentally be valuing women. And that is where this debate has to go.
Let me toss that to you first, Dahlia. Are we having the right or the wrong conversation here?
Well, both. I think it's a yes and. I think we're having the right conversation for all the reasons Stephanie just said. We're having the right conversation because it needs to be had, because every single woman who has stepped forward and said, me too, had something to say and was failed by existing structures. I think that undergirding what Senator Gillibrand said there is the scary part, the wrong conversation, which is we don't have to tease out the difference between flirting and actual grievous misconduct and assault. It's all bad. That's bad. I think we can agree, or at least I would hope we can agree, that we need processes, and processes exist, right? If we were to say we're tossing out the difference between first degree murder and, you know, second degree murder, and it's all the same, that would be pernicious and dangerous. We have systems and processes in order to do the hard work of ferreting out what is first, second, third degree misconduct, sexual predation. And so I think that there are two things that she's saying. One of them is critical, which is these systems and processes have failed, and so we have to do more. And at the same time, I think there's an element of this, which is, and I think it is fomenting a bit of a backlash, which is saying we're not going to take the time to do processes anymore. We're not going to investigate. We're going to just, you know, purge the Senate of anyone against whom there are any claims without scrutiny into, you know, differentiating who the claimant is and what the claim is. I think that is dangerous. I also think we need to recognize that speech, and I think the Me Too movement that we're seeing in Hollywood, the Time's Up movement, what we're seeing in the Academy, what we're seeing this week in the media with this men list, this media men list, all of this is women saying, I'm not doing process anymore. Process has failed me. So we're going to do it self-help, and there's going to be some casualties, and we're going to figure it out later. I think that's what she's saying.
Well, I'd be curious about how you see this, Stephanie. And also, if I can quote from Daphne Merkin, had an interesting piece in the New York Times. I'm sure she had a fair amount of pushback. But she said, and she wrote, in private, it's a different story. Grow up. This is real life. I hear these same feminists say, whatever happened to flirting? And what about women who are the predators? Some women, including random people I talk to in supermarkets, have gone so far as to say this is an outright witch hunt. Perhaps even more troubling is that we may seem to be returning to a victimology paradigm for young women in particular, in which they're perceived to be, or perceive themselves to be, as frail as Victorian housewives. And it seems that in this whole discussion about harassment and even sexual assault, it's so hard to find that middle ground, I guess, that covers all the issues. And I think for some people, a touch on the knee feels like a sexual assault. For others, it's just someone being a jerk. How do we sort of struggle our way through this?
Well, I certainly don't have the answer to that, but it's the right question to ask, and we all need to be asking it. We can't just pursue this stuff on Twitter. You know, and as Talia said, not only we don't know, we have to do processing, but we also have to ensure DUE process to people. We also have to remember how long and how embedded these behaviors were, including, you know, she says it's been going on for so long. Yes, but it's only really been in the last 20 years that we have decided that it's not appropriate. So it's going to take us a while to make a distinction between the ones who have begun to learn that. Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting, Sarah Huckabee claimed that we should only focus on the men who admit the sexist behaviors and apologize and leave alone those who deny it. I think it might be almost the opposite. Somebody starts admitting and apologizing, I mean, that's not going to get them off of actual, you know, criminal behavior, but it's something that we should take seriously, just as we women have to understand that some of the ways that we have behaved, like pretending that we want the man to propose to us, you know, we want the man to take the initiative in certain circumstances. So we need to understand that kind of thing has enabled and encouraged and confused many otherwise well-intentioned men. And, of course, it's enabled the really badly intentioned men, too. So we all have to step back from this, I think, be absolutely clear that this is not going to continue going forward. But as you said, there are these gray areas, and we have to learn to deal with those gray areas.
Well, if I can put you on the spot again, Dahlia, only because I see Kozinski. This is Alex Kozinski, the judge that you had written about and had experiences with, apologizing, saying, "I had a broad sense of humor, a candid way of speaking to both male and female law clerks alike. In doing so, I may not have been mindful enough of the special challenges and pressures that women face in the workplace. It grieves me to learn that I caused any of my clerks to feel uncomfortable. This was never my intent. For this, I sincerely apologize." He goes on to say, "You know, I'm going to retire because I can't defend myself and also be an effective judge." That's an apology. What do we do with something like that?
Can I just say that that's not what I mean by an apology?
Okay, fair
that's
enough.
I'm sorry that you felt bad about it.
I hear.
Go on, Dahlia.
Yeah,
sorry.
Go ahead, Dahlia.
No, I think I would I would like to associate myself with Stephanie's remarks. I think that you know, that's the "I'm sorry you feel bad" is not I think the apology that most women are looking for. But I think. I would add two other things. I think one thing that's so important about that apology, and it's the one we hear from Franken, we hear it from Louis C.K., we hear it from Brett Ratner, you know, folks in Hollywood, and it's this, look, I just have this culture of, like, waka waka, and it's funny, and sex, and, you know, we live in these creative industries, and we live on that line. I think that is of a piece with this larger tendency to say, and you may note, you know, this week Catherine Deneuve and a whole bunch of French women came forward against Me Too, saying exactly that, you know, creativity can't happen if everybody is self-censoring and everyone is terrified and there's going to be this huge backlash. So I think there is this basket of justification that goes, look, you know, we're a freewheeling workplace and I'm sorry you don't have a sense of humor. And I think that gets it exactly upside down, because if you are in a position of power and a position to say, I am now mandating that we are a freewheeling workplace in which we all get to talk about sex and touch each other and show each other pornography with impunity because that's what I've decreed, that's actually not a consensual agreement. And so I think that whether it's Louis C.K. or Al Franken, and I want to stipulate, I think this is so important, these people have not had due process, as Stephanie says. We don't know which of these allegations are true and are not true. I think it's a tragedy that we have not had a process around Al Franken and, in fact, around a federal judge about who these allegations have been made. It would be good to know definitively what happened, but I don't think it's a defense to say, I'm funny and you're not funny and you just didn't get me and I'm so sorry you misperceived what I thought was just a freewheeling creative atmosphere. Women who work in subordinate positions don't get to agree to that. They have to accede to that and then to be told, well, I just thought you acceded to it because it was hilarious for everyone, isn't an apology. If I could just say one
sure,
other thing,
ahead.
I think in response to the Daphne Merkin piece that you asked Stephanie about, a really good piece in the Chronicle of Higher Education by Sarah Moore makes the point that I think is the answer to the Daphne Merkin, you know, oh, we can't flirt anymore, you know, we're going to create a witch hunt and a backlash, and this is going to purge all workplaces of any joy and fun. Sarah Marr says, and I think this is Rebecca Traister made this point as well, this isn't about sex. This is about work. And I think that's, for me, the bottom answer here. That if we talk about this through the lens of sex and flirting and touching and porn, we're getting it wrong. This is a conversation about the conditions under which women, who most of whom have to work, under which they work. And I think to frame it as a conversation about sex and Victorianism and flirting is to fundamentally lose before we begin. This is a conversation about the workplace and under what conditions women can work and what extra burdens they have to take on. If women have to take on the burden of tolerating sexual abuse or being shown porn or having someone talk to their breasts instead of their face, that's extra work that women are doing in the workplace. That's, it seems to me, the place to start this conversation.
We are talking about the Me Too movement and where it goes from here. That's Dahlia Lithwick. She writes about the courts and the law for Slate. Also, she hosts the podcast called Amicus. Stephanie Kuntz joining us as well. And again, she teaches history and family studies at the Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington. And you can join our conversation. Where do you see this movement going? And again, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me read a couple of comments here. One from Barry, by the way, call me crazy, but Oprah was pretty tight with Weinstein, was a Hollywood elite, so I can't help but thinking that she knew what was going on, but she kept it quiet. A tweet from Eric, Me Too has nothing to do with gender equality since women are just as capable of sexual abuse as men. Power corrupts. The way to end abuse is to end power by creating a society self-managed by workers. An email from Tony, please talk about Garrison Keillor's case. The headline, I guess, says Garrison Keillor accused of inappropriate behavior from Minnesota Public Radio. And again, you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. Stephanie, speaking about the Garrison Keillor thing, and I don't have extra special knowledge about what he is accused of, but is that part of what concerns you? Is that, and perhaps, you know, back in the 60s there were few consequences for inappropriate behavior, but now in some instances it feels as if there are too few protections for inappropriate behavior.
I'm not sure that we want to protect inappropriate.
Well, I kind of felt weird as those words came out of my mouth, but yes.
But I think that it's really true that we do need to distinguish between the inappropriate behavior that we need to be able to confront, but that we don't necessarily have to go after in the same way that we should and be totally entitled to go after the illegal behavior. I mean, what Dahlia said is absolutely right. These are working condition issues, and actually that raises a source of potential solidarity against the supposed backlash that actually might have a little bit of truth in it. But, the fact is that workers of all kinds do not have much power to say, I'm doing my job right. You should not impose these other things in my life, whether it's teasing me about not being man enough to stand up to my wife if I say I need time off to go to a doctor appointment with my kid, or whether it's trying to expose me to this kind of sexually demeaning or just gender demeaning talk. I mean, it doesn't always have to do with sex, the kind of attitudes that go on. And yet we have very few protections. And so I think that's the place that we really have to work at the same time as we educate people about what it means to live in a world where it is no longer men's prerogative or duty to be always the initiator, and women's duty to be nice, to deflect things with a smile, to be aggressive, to be silent.
Do you think, Dahlia, and of course there are no easy answers here, but if there were more women in more positions of power, this would be less of a problem?
It's such a good question, Marty. I when we did an Amicus podcast 2 weeks ago with some of the women in the federal clerkship scenario who came forward against Judge Kaczynski, one of the things that I asked was this question of if we had parity, if we had 50-50 women judges, if we had equal numbers of women even clerking, would this change? And I think one of the things that some of the accusers said really resonated with me, which is, of course, parity is going to make a difference. But think about the difference between Anita Hill 25 years ago and today, think of what it means to have Kirsten Gillibrand and Amy Klobuchar and Dianne Feinstein. Yesterday in the Senate, Senator Mazie Hirono began a protocol that she says she's going to continue with every single nominee that comes before the Judiciary Committee. She's going to simply say, have you ever been accused of sexual harassment? Just laying down a marker. And I interviewed her about it, and I said, do you really think people are going to come forward and say, well, Senator, yes, I shouldn't have this judgeship? No, that's not the point. The point is to say it. And I asked her, are you a little bit annoyed that the woman in the Senate is you know, the one who's initiating this tradition of asking overtly about it? And she said, if I had waited for a man to ask this question, I'm not sure it would have happened. And so I think that it would be great. There's no doubt in my mind if we got to a world where it was 50% women and 50% men, a lot of these behaviors would fade away. But I think I don't want to understate how important it is just to have some, that the difference between Anita Hill sitting in front of an all-male Judiciary Committee and what we see today, which is a Judiciary Committee that has these strong, amazing, you know, Kamala Harris, Amy Klobuchar, Senator Hirono, who are standing there and saying, we're done. We're just done allowing this. And I think that's such a shift. It's a sea change even from 6 months ago. And so I want to say, let's shoot toward 50-50. Let's shoot to real parity. But let's also recognize, I think, that women are doing extraordinary work, even though we don't have parity. They are taking on burdens that men are not yet taking on.
Let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. We got a lot of folks that want to join it as well. I'm not surprised. Talking about where the Me Too movement, for lack of a better word, goes from here. Dahlia Lithwick, again, writes about the courts and law for Slate, hosts of the podcast Amicus. Stephanie Kuntz teaches history and family studies at the Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington, also serves as director of research and public education at the Council on Contemporary Families. And we want to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen, and if you're just joining us, talking with Stephanie Kuntz and Dahlia Lithwick about the Me Too movement that has gotten so much attention in the last 6 months or so. It's been around for a lot longer than that, and we're talking about where things go from here. Let me get Bob from Philadelphia to join us. And Bob, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hey, good morning. Good morning. One of the problems that this is facing and the perpetuation of this and why it doesn't stop is you got to sit back and think why. One of the reasons is men are in positions of power, coupled with many women, especially in the Republican Party, want to be subservient to men still. And this is an ongoing problem that has to be addressed. I'll take the comments off.
Okay, fair enough. Do you want to tackle that, Stephanie?
Well, I think it's absolutely true. You don't, you know, there's no guarantee that women are always the foremost supporters of gender equality. Many are committed to an ideal that involves women deferring to men in return for supposedly for protection, which does not always follow, but but no. That's what that some of them believe. So, yeah, you have to take that into account. But, you know, to go back to this question of we are not having parity in workplaces. There's a sort of, I think, circular thing that goes on here because, you know, the desegregation of many blue-collar workplaces has really stalled, and also in some even more professional workplaces like STEM fields that have long been associated with sort of male kinds of stereotypes of male competency and stuff. And so sexual harassment and gender harassment, and again, I think it's important that we distinguish those, may well have something to do with how difficult it is to gain parity in some of these fields. So it's something that we're going to have to work on in many, many ways. It's a big question. But I love the fact that we are having this conversation and trying to put nuance into it. There are things that are not nuanced, you know, like this has got to end.
Sure.
But there are the other nuances. And if we don't address them, we do leave ourselves vulnerable to losing potential allies and to getting the kind of backlash that people have talked about.
Let me put something to you, Dahlia, and then we'll get back to some of our listeners here. I'm thinking about zero tolerance, and I think that's what Kirsten Gillibrand was talking about in many ways, which is just, you know, we will not tolerate certain kinds of behavior. But I wonder if there are risks associated with that. I think of how zero tolerance has been applied to schools, and minor incidents then get treated like major ones. And sometimes you hear these heartbreaking stories about first graders who, you know, essentially get almost arrested because they brought a butter knife to school. Is there a danger, you think, there?
Yeah, I think that's what I was flicking at when I was saying, you know, one worries when she says it's all the same, we'll treat it all the same. Zero tolerance is legal shorthand for do away with process. And I want to be really clear that that is, in my view, for the exact reason you've identified in the school context, zero tolerance is a way of taking away the power to investigate, to scrutinize, to evaluate, and to say, sometimes based on the thinnest allegations, you're out. And we know who gets, in zero tolerance context, the people who suffer are unerringly the poorest and the most disadvantaged. So zero tolerance may start as a regime of protecting women. It never ends as a regime of protecting anyone but the people who are already powerful. And so I am not a fan in any context. And I wrote a piece about even Al Franken saying, you know, I believe in systems. I believe in investigations. I believe in letting our ability to assess the difference between what is a 1 and a 10 on the Richter scale, letting that play out. So I agree with you that, you know, zero tolerance is clearly not the answer, and that was what I was resisting in even Senator Gillibrand's remarks. But I want to, I think, add one nuance even to what Stephanie just said, and I think it's based on what Bob the Caller said, and that is, if we have systems in which men are in power, and that's Hollywood, and that's publishing, and that's most of the world, and then we have what are ostensible protections for women in the workplace, and then we construct workarounds. So, for instance, the reason Harvey Weinstein was protected for so long was these NDAs, these non-disclosure agreements, the sort of machinery of law firms bullying women into retracting their claims or into being paid off. That was a system that we've identified, by the way, in the federal judicial clerkship context, where clerks agree to perfect confidentiality with their judges. So I think that in addition to sort of saying we need to have processes, I think that we need to look at the ways we've constructed workarounds so that the processes don't work. And if there is a workaround that says, as a condition of your employment, you either sign this thing that gives away all your legal rights, or you sign this thing that gives perfect confidentiality, or you sign whatever you're signing, you know, that something that suggests this doesn't get litigated, it goes to arbitration and the company pays for it. Whatever the system is that we've constructed to do an end round around processes is its own form, in a way, of zero tolerance. It's zero tolerance for the accuser. And so I think really built into this conversation, we have to think very critically about how it is that we believed we had a whole system that protected us legally in the workplace that was so easily deconstructed by powerful men for all these legal reasons that we have to assess now.
Let me see what's...
Can I add something to that?
Yeah, and then let me get Sissy from Newtown Square. But go ahead, Stephanie.
Well, just two quick things. First of all, the workarounds and this no disclosure, it's not just men. I mean, there are women corporation leaders who use these too, because it's a way of preventing any kind of complaints from people who have been victimized in the workplace for whatever reason. So, I completely agree that we have to get rid of those, and that's a worker's protection right, not just a women's protection right. On the zero tolerance one, let me just add one more reason to be worried about zero tolerance, and that is the history. As I've tried to say earlier, you know, it's really only in the last 20 years that we have decided this kind of behavior is out of bounds. Now, rape was always supposedly out of bounds, and even then, though, it was winked at. But so there's one, if something has happened 20, 25 years ago, you got to distinguish between whether it was actually rape or sexual assault, or whether it was a kind of behavior that we should now have no total zero tolerance for, but that was part of the climate there, and that should be accounted for, apologized for, discussed, improved, but maybe not gone after in the same way.
I want to pick up on that, but first let me get Sissy from Newtown Square to join us. Hi, Sissy. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
How are you? I was calling because I thought one thing that hasn't been mentioned much, and I think this is a horrendous issue, so it's not to be minimized, is there are really good men out there. My husband, 9 years ago, was a CEO of a small company, so in a powerful position, and a woman came in who just worked in his office and complained about being sexually harassed and by one of his more successful people, and within 10 minutes he fired him. I mean, I do think that there are good men who know what to do. You know, I raised my son with boys will be boys is not allowed. It just is not tolerated. That's not an excuse in your life. And I think good men need to be recognized, and men and women need to be raising these boys to recognize what is unacceptable.
Absolutely, Sissy. I think you get no argument from any of us, and hopefully from none of our listeners as well. I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Thanks so much. Let me read, where did that go? We had someone who's a member of SAG and AFTRA talked about the fact that he had seen Louis C. I guess he gets to vote on awards and things like that, saw Louis C.K.'s movie, and he said, you know, it was a really good movie. And I guess for Dahlia and to you, Stephanie, which is this, you know, the person, the behavior, the art, perhaps, in this case, how do we struggle through some of that? Dahlia?
First of all, I just want to say something that Sissy, if I may, and that is, you know, in the past month, me making a decision even to write about an experience that happened to me a long time ago, you know, but for my husband, but for my male co-clerks who came forward, every single person who corroborated my reporting was a male.
Yeah.
And by the way, I just want to say my 14-year-old son who, you know, rocked my world last month by unequivocally supporting my decision to report something. And so I could not agree more. I often say Justice Stephen Breyer is the fifth feminist on the Supreme Court and gets no credit. So I can't, you know, I can't agree enough that this is about, I think Stephanie used the word allies, and I completely concur that we need to be so grateful for our male allies. Just on the question of separating the work from the alleged predator. I worry so much about purging. You know, we're going to get rid of all movies made by, we're going to get rid of, you know, there was talk about taking, in this instance, Judge Kaczynski's work out of casebooks. I think we have to be very, very much smarter and, again, more nuanced about not, you know, destroying our canons because we don't like the behavior of the person who did some of it. And I think that if we go back and purge, you know, our literary and musical and artistic and cultural canons of any man who, you know, as Stephanie said, that mores have changed. You know, if we think about Percy Shelley, if we think about William Shakespeare, if we think about Albert Einstein and how they treated women, there would be nothing left in our culture. So I think we have to really be much more savvy about saying you can hate the behavior and still honor the work.
Stephanie, let me pick up on something you referenced earlier, and Dahlia just referenced it as well, which is that there were different mores or rules a generation or more ago. And I have to say that just in the many conversations I've had with people over the last 6 months or so, a number of men have said, you know, when I look back at my life, there are things I probably shouldn't have done. I don't think I'm a criminal. But there is a fair amount of soul searching and even worry that somehow they might get outed because of something jerky or stupid that they did.
Yes, yes. And that's a legitimate worry. On the other hand, this is the sort of behavior that it's good for them to think through, and perhaps to have their own Me Too movement. You know, I did some of this too. I'm really sorry. Or to at least go to the person, see if you can find the person that you did it to, and send an apology to that. But these are very, you know, we are dealing with gender norms that are very entrenched. They tend to be highly exploitative, the ones that were given to the messages that were given to young men. But it's also true that the messages given to women were tended to be, you know, help us be victims, or at least or to deny being victims, but to enable the victimization by trying to always please, you know, not being assertive about things, not being able to recognize when we do have want to take the initiative sexually. So all of these things, you know, are very, very complicated, very deep-rooted. Like I said earlier, you know, most young women that I know, even the ones who consider themselves feminists, are just absolutely insist that the man takes the risk of doing the proposal, you know? And so when the man takes the risk of, you know, moving in for the kiss that you don't want, how different is that, you know? And so we all have to rethink these kinds of things, which is not to say that we don't say zero tolerance from here on out.
Let me read an email from Patricia. She says, I believe we missed the point when we framed the Me Too movement within the work environment. Teenage girls nowadays are harassed more than we were in the past. They are constantly being asked for nudes and receive explicit, unsolicited pictures and sexual advances on their mobile phones. And the worst part is that they see it as normal and take it for granted. Dahlia, what do you say in response?
I absolutely agree, and I'm glad she makes the point. I think, and again, my 14-year-old son is the one who said, if we can't reckon with what Hollywood produces in terms of the culture, then it's awfully hard to have an honest conversation about predation in Hollywood. And so I think, you know, if you think about the fact that, you know, being skinny and having, you know, a perfect body and being naked in movies and the sort of endless, you know, rinse repeat cycle of, you know, a musical and movie culture that views women in certain ways, then you can't really have a realistic conversation about how the men and women who produce that then behave in the workplace. So I certainly think, and there's no doubt in my mind, that, you know, the advent of new technologies are making it possible to really ramp up the objectification and sexualization that girls endure in ways that were unimaginable 100 years ago. So there's no question this is braided into the culture, but I do think it's important to have a crisp conversation about workplace harassment. It's a kind of a yes and. Yes, we have to have a meaningful conversation about how our culture views girls, as Stephanie said, how we view consent, how we train young girls, you know, through the messages they get. And that's important. I don't think it obviates the need for a separate and equally urgent conversation about how workplace protections for women are failing us. So it's not as though I think one obscures the other. I think they're both of a piece of this larger problem we have, which is we thought we solved all of this in the 60s. We thought we solved it again after Anita Hill. We haven't solved for it. What do we do better? And I think in both fronts, we need to reckon with that.
Well, a perfect way to end our conversation. Dahlia Lithwick, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you.
And she writes about the courts and the law for Slate. Again, she hosts the podcast Amicus. Stephanie Coutts, thank you for joining us as well.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks.
You're very welcome. I should add, she got up at 5 o'clock in the morning in Hawaii to join us on Radio Times. Much appreciated. And she teaches history and family studies at the Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington. Serves as Director of Research and Public Education at the Council on Contemporary Families. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times to find out much more about this program. And we appreciate all those comments and calls to the show as well. Bob Ball's the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you for joining us.